I'd like to welcome you all to session 166, A Mormon Bigfoot, David Patton's Cain and the Conception of Evil in Mormon Folklore. And what else do I need to say? Oh, you're going to be very embarrassed if your cell phone rings in the middle of this, so make sure it's silent. And I'd like to introduce Matt Bowman today. We do not have a respondent, and so he will take up as much time as he'd like and open it up to questions. Matt Bowman is a PhD candidate in history at Georgetown University and a 2010 to 2011 Charlotte Newcomb Fellow. He's writing a dissertation on the rise of evangelical fundamentalism in early 20th century New York City, but has also written several articles on Mormon history and culture as well. He currently serves as associate editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought.
This is going to be fun. I am only sorry that I do not have pictures. Who here has heard that Bigfoot is in fact Cain? That's about what I thought. This is what I grew up hearing when I grew up 10 minutes to the north of here in Woods Cross, Utah. I'd heard this since I was but a lad, and I thought for a long time that I had come up with the arrow that would puncture this theory and utterly destroy it. So once, when I was, I think, a valiant or something, like when I was 11 years old, and my valiant A teacher told us this story, I raised my hand and I said, "But how did he survive the flood?" And I was told that he clung to the outside of the ark. So there went that theory. This is one thing Mormons are very good at, is coming up with answers. So, unfortunately, though, I'm not going to prove to you that Bigfoot exists, or disprove it, I guess, for that matter. I'm going to talk about folklore, primarily, and the way that folklore changes, and the ways in which folklore is a useful tool to understand ourselves, and to understand the ways our culture develops, and our culture changes. Folklore reflects us. It reflects our anxieties, our preoccupations, our concerns, the things that we are worried about, and the way we feel about how the world works. And for a long time, American folklorists believed that the folklore of small, distinctive groups, like the Mormons, would actually be overwhelmed and absorbed and destroyed by the folklore of the larger cultural community that surrounded it. A guy named Hector Lee, who wrote a book about the three Nephites, made this case. And here's a useful example. You may have heard this story. There is a young man who goes to a dance. And at that dance, he asks various young women to dance, and he strikes out over and over and over again until one girl agrees to dance with him. But after they dance, she vanishes into the crowd, and he doesn't know where she is going. He spends the rest of his time hunting for her, but he cannot find her, and so he drives home in despair. But on the way home, hark, he sees her, and she is standing by the side of the road with a sweater around her shoulders, and he pulls over. He's delighted to give her a ride home, and she gives him her address, and he takes her home. But when he gets to her house and gets out of the door to open her door for her, because he's that sort of young man, she's not there. He opens the passenger door and she is gone, and he is very, very confused about this. So he goes and knocks on the door and tells the old man who answers, "There's a girl who told me that this was her house." And the old man says, oh yes, there was a girl. Is this her? And he shows the boy a picture. And he says, that was my daughter who died in a car wreck 10 years ago. You've probably heard that story before. This is a variation on what's called the Vanishing Hitchhiker tale. It's quite common in Mormon folklore. Now, here is one that was told at BYU only 20 years ago. Two young men in a car driving home. And they see an old man by the side of the road. And they pick him up and they put him in the back seat. And as they're driving, this old man utters something portentous about food storage. And then he vanishes. And of course, this was a Nephite. We see here then the ways in which these stories can be adapted to a particularly Mormon context, the ways in which American folklore and Mormon folklore blend into each other. And even then, in that assimilation, we can see the ways in which Mormons cling to what is distinctive and important about us, what we believe about ourselves. And that, then, is what we can learn from Bigfoot. I want to talk, then, about Mormon Cain folklore and Bigfoot folklore more broadly, and the ways in which the two interact and blend into each other. And for my purposes, we have two periods here, pre-1978 and post-1978. A number of themes are woven into that timeline, themes of the supernatural and the natural, but of course the clearest is this is the date of the revocation of the ban on black members of the church holding the priesthood. That is a key date, and I will tell you why a little bit later. We should then begin in Tennessee in 1832 with David W. Patton. Who knows who David Patton is? Most of you should because you go to Sunstone. Oh, okay, about a third of you. David Patton was an early president of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, and he served for a time as a missionary in Tennessee. He stayed with the family of who was then a young boy named Abraham O. Smoot. And many years later, Smoot wrote a letter to Joseph F. Smith describing a story that Patton told him. Patton came home one day on his horse, and he had a face as white as snow, and he looked shocked and stunned, and this young boy came out. Abraham Smith said, "What is wrong?" And Patton told him the following. While he was riding his horse back, he, quote, met with a very remarkable personage who represented himself as being Cain, who had murdered his brother Abel. As Patton said, "I suddenly noticed a very strange personage walking beside me for about 2 miles. His head was about even with my shoulders as I sat in my saddle. He wore no clothing, but was covered in hair. His skin was very dark. He said he had no home, that he was a wanderer in the earth. He said he was a very miserable creature, that he had earnestly sought death, but that he could not die, and that his mission was to destroy the souls of men. I rebuked him in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and by virtue of the holy priesthood, and commanded him to go hence, and he immediately departed out of my sight." Now, this is the scene. This is the first of these stories that appear in Mormon folklore. And we have some evidence that this story was actually reasonably well known among the Mormons of the 19th century. In 1893, the Quorum of the Twelve discussed this story, and this precipitated Joseph F. Smith writing to Smoot and asking for this letter. Abraham Cannon's journal, Abraham Cannon was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve at this point, and he made notes on this session and said, "I had always supposed that Cain was dead, but I may have been wrong." In 1884, Eliza R. Snow wrote a poem about this, at least in part. The relevant stanza is, "As seen by David Patton, he was dark. When pointing at his face of glossy jet, Cain said, 'You see, the curse is on me yet. The first of murderers, now he fills his post and reigns as king over all the murderous hosts.'" Now, this casual reference to David Patton seeing this being indicates that Eliza believed that her audience would understand this reference. And this, of course, goes down even to the present day. In the Miracle of Forgiveness, on page 127 and 128, Spencer W. Kimball recounts this story. There was actually even a novel recently written by a member of the church named Seth Lester. This book is called The Clan of Cain and involves some Bigfoot hunters going after this creature. So, this is something then that's very, very deep in our folklore as a people. This is something people talk about, people are aware of, and as we saw earlier, about 2/3 of the people here had heard this story themselves. Why did it seem so plausible? Why did so many people believe it? To answer that, I want to get boring for a moment and talk about the Apostle Paul. And more specifically, what the Apostle Paul believed about sin, as we see in the Epistle to the Romans. When Paul consistently refers to sin, not as wrong action, not as something that we simply do that screws up our lives, but rather sin as an external force, something that is capable of exerting power over us. As he says in chapter 7, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do is not what I do, but what I hate to do. It is no longer myself who does it, but the sin which lives in me. We see here then a way of thinking about evil in the world that makes it tangible and makes it something separate from our actions alone, makes it a force that is capable of exerting power over us. And this is the way that Mormons in the 19th century thought about evil. This is perhaps most dramatically illustrated by Heber Kimball and his adventures while on a mission in Great Britain. As he said once, a legion of wicked spirits, as plain as I now see you, they came as close to me as you now are. They came to me as I was laying hands on Brother Russell and dragged him to the very door of the room. Kimball was not alone in describing experiences like this. Kimball said that when he told Joseph Smith about this experience, the prophet, quote, told me that he had had contests with the devil face to face. He told me how he had been handled and afflicted by the devil, that he had known circumstances when Elder Rigdon was pulled out of his bed 3 times in one night. Brigham Young said that every person who desires and strives to be a saint is closely watched by fallen spirits. They are visiting the human family with manifestations. These early saints lived in that Pauline world, a world in which good and evil were manifest in physical and tangible ways, and more, a world in which evil was getting increasingly pissed off. When John Young dedicated the cornerstone of the Salt Lake Temple, he said, I very well know that at the commencement of this temple and those that have heretofore been built in the name of the Lord by this people, the devil has always moved his artillery with greatest power at that time. I pray that we will all be nerved up with power to accomplish the great works we are called to perform. So then this concept that Cain could be an agent of Satan, sent to destroy the work of the saints, is not terribly foreign. And indeed, this is precisely how we see Cain in David Patton's story and in other early stories, as an intelligent and malevolent agent seeking to destroy the growth of the church particularly. An emissary sent from Satan to destroy the Mormons in their valley, and one to be confronted then, not with weapons or guns or swords, but in explicitly religious ways. One of the most famous encounters with Cain echoes all of these themes. This is a story told by E. Wesley Smith, president of the Hawaiian Mission, right before the dedication of the Hawaii Temple in 1921. This one is in church archives. As Smith wrote, a man came through the door, and he was tall enough to have to stoop to enter. His eyes were protruding and wild-looking. His fingernails were thick and long. He presented an unkempt appearance, and he wore no clothes at all. There suddenly appeared in my right hand a light, which had the size and the appearance of a dagger, and a voice said, "This is your priesthood." He commanded the person in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ to depart, and immediately when the light appeared, the person stopped, and upon being commanded to leave, he backed out of the door. Now, E. Wesley Smith was rather shaken up by this, and he went to his relative, who happened to be Joseph Fielding Smith, and asked him what this was. And Joseph Fielding Smith identified the visitor, according to Wesley, in this way: "It is Cain, whose curse is to roam the earth, seeking whom he may destroy." And Joseph Fielding then went on to echo John Young's themes almost exactly, describing Cain as, quote, "a representative of the spirit of the adversary, of which there was always unusual evidence for a period just prior to the dedication of any temple." Joseph Fielding Smith then referred Wesley to a copy of Lycurgus Wilson's biography of David Patton, which contained a reproduction of Patton's letter. Here are a few other folk tales from this period. One tale from the 1920s spoke of a nameless apostle whose car had broken down while he was in Mexico, quote, "checking up on the mission there." While the apostle was walking through the desert trying to find help, he encountered, quote, "a very large man, about 7 feet tall, and dark and hairy, coming towards him. The apostle asked him who he was, and he said his name was Cain, and he tried to overpower the apostle, who cast him out with the authority of the priesthood." Another story, collected in 1961. A devout young man who had just been recently called to the office of bishop. One evening, he was working late into the night, and he began to feel as though something might be wrong. And a monstrous, tall, dark figure covered with black hair walked into his office, and this figure had the appearance of what one would think Cain to have had. The bishop felt that its intent was to destroy him, and he called out, "By the authority of the priesthood of God, I command you to leave." Another story from the 1970s told of two boys from the Bear River Valley who had been called on their mission. And while they were out riding their horses, they saw a big hairy creature who scared their horses. They went to their state president, who told them it was Cain. And we see then, in all three of these stories, the same themes I have noted over and over and over again. Cain follows the pattern set by David Patton. He sometimes identifies himself, even if not the story identifies him. He seeks to disrupt the work of the church. He is particularly interested in harassing missionaries. He is cast out, finally, by the priesthood. So Cain, then, serves a double purpose here. He is a symbol of this tangible supernatural evil, but he is also, paradoxically, an indication of the glory of the church as it continues to rise, because in every single case, Cain is overthrown, defeated, sent back, destroyed. This interpretation of this story then persists well into the modern period. We've seen then Joseph Fielding Smith seemed to take it for granted. We saw that Spencer W. Kimball reproduced Patton's experience in The Miracle of Forgiveness as an example of punishment. But there is another feature common to most of these stories from the early 20th century, and that is in that nearly every single one, Cain is described as dark or black. This is more problematic and cannot be explained so simply. Now, of course, this may go back all the way to Orson Pratt and speculation about blacks as less valiant souls, as fence-sitters in the war in heaven, the convoluted racial discourse of early Mormonism. This doctrine and this belief in it was probably even more common than simply stories of Cain alone. But it was tied also to these very present notions of supernatural evil in the world. The Puritans frequently referred to Satan as being an African or a black man. This is inherited then, perhaps, into the Mormon discourse as well. And we see in the 19th century, frequently throughout Mormonism, stories of apostates whose skin darkens, converted Indians whose skin lightens, and so on and so forth. And another story makes all of these themes explicit. Missionaries were tracting a white section of a town in Georgia and were surprised when a huge black Negro came to the door and hurled obscenities at them. His face was hideous, and the missionaries left, much frightened. Their mission president later told them that this man was Cain, that the town was very wicked, and they should no longer labor there. Now, this is interesting indeed. This one was collected in the 1960s, and it's a very good example of this imagery of Cain, this other story about Cain, which accompanies that of him being an emissary of Satan, which is him being the archetypical cursed black man. And, fascinatingly enough, in this story, the priesthood loses. Cain is not cast out. He is not rejected. The missionaries are told to avoid him. And that perhaps reflects the troubled nature of the church's relationship with race in the 1960s. Now then, we know that the priesthood ban was revoked in 1978, and that this sort of folk doctrine has come under increasing fire since that point. What then happens to Cain in the past 30 years? Where does he go? To get at that, I want to divert a little bit from Mormon folklore and talk about something else. Namely, the events in northern Davis County in February of 1980. On Sunday, February 3rd, in the morning, a woman named Paula Markham went to her sink to get a glass of water before she went to church. And she looked out of the window over her sink that morning and saw, quote, a big black creature climbing a ridge outside her home. And according to the Ogden Standard Examiner, who asked her what she did upon seeing this, she said, "I put my glass down and went to church." Early the next morning, a man named Ronald Smith looked out of his window and saw, quote, a big dark creature in his field. He went out, walked around his house, went back in, and heard his horses whinnying in fear. He saw tracks around his barn. Now, these are the Bigfoot sightings of Utah in February 1980. And Jay Barker, a reporter for the Ogden Standard Examiner, was very interested in these because he himself had seen Bigfoot 3 years earlier when he was up hiking in the Rocky Mountains. And what is interesting and fascinating and odd about all of these stories compared to this earlier folklore is that none of these stories talk about Cain at all. None of them make this connection. None of them use supernatural language. They describe what they saw in very natural and animalistic terms. Ronald Smith, for instance, said he had heard sounds in his barn, but he assumed that it was a cougar. Jay Barker, upon tracking Bigfoot through the mountains, said, quote, "I thought it had returned to the mountains with its young." He notes a seeing paw prints in the snow. When he saw Bigfoot, he said, "I initially thought I was looking at an elk." So we are, seemingly here, quite far from Cain and David Patton. But we're somewhat close to another way of thinking about this creature. And that is to the work of a man named John Green and the Patterson film. In October of 1967, a man named Roger Patterson filmed 30 seconds of 8mm footage near Bluff Creek in Northern California. This film, which you can see on YouTube, shows a large, hairy, heavy creature with long arms staring into the camera and then turning and loping away. As the prominent Bigfoot researcher, or hominologist, John Green says, this film changed everything. Before the Patterson film, most stories of Bigfoot equated Bigfoot with vampires and ghosts and demons. Think here of Grendel, of the Skin Changers, of the Wendigo, the Green Man of medieval folklore. The Patterson film, however, created single-handedly what Green calls hominology, the scientific study of the creature Sasquatch. People like John Green, like Lauren Coleman, like Janet and Colin Nord insist that we should replace the term Bigfoot with other, less goofy forms of nomenclature and treat this creature as we would any other. They study things and produce vast and important papers on things like Sasquatch mating patterns and dropping studies and whether or not the creature is omnivorous or not. They have concluded that they are, in fact, nocturnal and solitary, that they will eat plants, but animals if they find them dead. They are not, they conclude, monsters to be feared. Now, back to Weber County. Clearly, then, the language, the imagery, the ideas of hominology can be seen here. But Kane is incorporated, and he is incorporated soon enough. Lee Bell, a local historian, reported in 1991 that by that year, 10 years after the sightings, local Mormons were identifying what they called their Bigfoot with Kane. And in 2003, the Deseret News, of all publications, wrote a story tracing the linking of these two folk cycles together. That is, identifying Bigfoot with Kane, but with a twist and a difference. In the most recent stories of Bigfoot and of Kane that Mormons tell to each other, produced since the mid-1980s, say, Bigfoot and Kane become increasingly interchangeable. And Kane's earlier distinguishing characteristics, his malevolent intelligence, his dark skin, his reputation as an emissary of Satan, begin to decline. And increasingly, encounters with him are characterized less and less and less as encounters between the power of Satan and God's priesthood. Here's a tale that might sound vaguely familiar. A group of Boy Scouts were on a camping trip when they heard strange noises. It was Kane. Kane chased them through the woods and into a cabin. They locked the door, but Kane tried to climb up onto the chimney. The boys prayed and then got an idea to light a fire in the fireplace. The boy who lit the fire looked up and saw a big hairy man's face in the fireplace right before it went up in flames. Later, they saw Kane running across the fields, yelping in pain. He'll huff and he'll puff. Kane's identity here is never questioned. It's from the very beginning, from that wonderful declarative sentence, it was Kane. But he is described here as an animal. There is no sense of demonic motives. He never speaks. Even prayer really doesn't have as much to do with them driving him away as lighting the fire does. His actions of climbing around on the roof and of yelping in pain are increasingly animalistic. Other stories are similar. Another collected in that same year tells of Kane stalking an old man's farmhouse late at night. This one emphasizes Kane's fright potential. It tells us that, quote, two horses died in the night from heart attacks because they were so afraid of its howls. And more depicts Kane himself reacting as any other predatory animal would, fleeing when the horses begin to stamp and kick in their stalls. Another story collected 2 years later describes the teller's grandfather, who late at night looked out his window and saw, quote, a big, huge, hairy man looking in at him. The grandfather closed his blinds and upon reopening them, quote, saw a huge, hairy beast running across his fields. He believed this man to be Bigfoot. And interestingly enough, within that story, the word Kane is never used, but the person who collected it for the folklore archives at USU described it as, quote, a Kane/Bigfoot story. So this is one way in which we can see this folklore moving. But there is another story, interestingly enough, that does associate Kane with the supernatural that was collected in the late 1980s. It goes as follows. A group of teenage boys were playing with a Ouija board. They were asking simple and fun questions. One of them had the idea, a very good idea, I would editorialize, to take the board to a graveyard. So they did. After a while, they begin asking deeper questions. And one boy asked, "Can we see Cain?" And the board said, "Yes." And all of a sudden, a huge man was standing on the hill. Everyone was scared of the man, so they ran to their car with him in hot pursuit. The guy driving screeched away and then drove everybody home. That night, Cain came into his bedroom and stood over his bed, but then left. The next morning, he decided it had never happened, but his mother asked him why he had been coming and going all night long. Now, this story does indeed associate Cain with the demonic, the diabolical, with the Ouija board, but it does so in interestingly twisted ways. That is, Cain here is not motivated by himself. Cain is not seeking to destroy the church here. Rather, the Ouija board is the center of the evil. Cain appears in reaction to it, to the wrong action of these boys. This is a morality tale. It is not warning of us that Cain is out there trying to destroy us. It is warning us not to do bad things. There is no priesthood confrontation here whatsoever. So, Cain's new actions here of stalking barns and running through fields seems far less satanic than does David Patton's Cain or the demon that stalked Wesley Smith. And indeed are increasingly reminiscent of these stories from Ogden in the early 1980s. Just as Cain's motives and demonic intelligence are increasingly removed, then we should also note that his racial identification has become increasingly muddled. One 1998 story rejects the notion of a curse of Cain entirely, instead saying that Bigfoot is, quote, an Indian spirit that turns into a hairy Cain-like creature. Another tale collected in 1990 mentions the curse but muddles the racial issues involved, stating that, quote, I learned in seminary that Cain was cursed not to die and to walk the earth all mongoloid-y. Notably, neither of these stories associate Cain with Africans, nor do they ascribe to him the sort of demonic motives that David Patton had mentioned. One 1997 story illustrates this trend with remarkable precision. Quote, a long time ago, maybe in Brigham Young's day, he was in a carriage when he saw a big, I mean huge, black man. Not like we think of a black man, but rather his countenance was dark and black. This tale seems to try to preserve this imagery and ideas of the Cain cycle, but explicitly tries to disassociate Cain from black human beings. In addition, none of these stories I've mentioned in the past few paragraphs use any racial language at all to describe Cain. In recent years, and it seems that the theological issues of race surrounding these stories have been downplayed in favor of the fright potential of the legends and their increasing association with traditional campfire fare like Indian spirits. Thus, it is my hypothesis here that the revocation of the priesthood ban, combined with repeated Bigfoot sightings in the 1980s, sparks a shift in Mormon Cain folklore that reflects the sort of cultural adaptation that we saw earlier on when I talked about the Vanishing Hitchhiker stories. No longer do Mormons think in these folktales of Cain as the archetypical cursed African man, and neither are the efforts of Satan understood now in such tangible and confrontational ways. The figure of Cain thus had to be reinvented, and the proximity of Bigfoot sightings allowed this to occur. I want to close in with one last story, which I think illustrates this very well. It is a retelling of David Patton's encounter, but it was told in 1997. Quote, during the early days of the church in New York State, a brother was riding his horse through a thicket of woods when he came across an extremely tall and frighteningly hairy creature roaming through the trees. This monstrous form stopped the man and told them that he was Cain, and it's because of that spotting that many members of the church believe that Cain is Bigfoot. Now notice what is left out here and what is added in. No longer is the word black used, neither is the sort of priesthood-driven exorcism invoked. Though Cain identifies himself, he no longer seeks to destroy the souls of men. We instead have new adjectives, frightening and monster-like. And of course, that last sentence, because of this, many members believe that Cain is Bigfoot, speaks for itself. Thank you. I'll take questions as long as you want. Yeah, come into the microphone.
Can't remember, I had it on my mind. A writer of these mysteries said this about Cain, why he was left to be not die, was that he was to be the father of one of Adam's wives. That's why he's kept alive, to be the father of one of Adam's wives. He had three wives. And one of them, they put a veil over her face, and that, he says that's the origin of the temple veil.
I've not heard the association with the Temple Veil, but otherwise what you're referring to actually is actually Jewish mythology surrounding Adam and his wives. And, you know, the book of Genesis is remarkably vague on precisely what actually Cain's fate was. And so there's a lot of room there for various traditions, I think, to kind of fill in.
Well, it's a threat to Adam and Eve's story if Cain goes out and finds a wife that's independent of God's creation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the name now. It's Francis W. Darter.
Ah, okay.
Who wrote these things. And I think David W. Patton wouldn't lie. One thing he did, he wrote an article, and it was published in the Elder's Journal, and Joseph Smith was the editor of it. He wrote the about the deliverer that would come forth in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, and he would take ungodliness away from the Gentiles. And he said, Joseph Smith is that deliverer.
Thank you.
Joseph then corrected.
All right, so my question.
Yeah.
I'm very fascinated with the idea of the stories that we tell, especially the stories that, folklore that is being generated now.
Yes.
On my mission, we had a term for the stories that were often passed around. We called them FPLs. Mm-hmm. You've ever heard that one, faith-promoting lies.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, I want two examples of something that I've come across. In my own state, there's this one story that's always been repeated about a very well-known member of our state who has a child with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And never from him, but from other people, I'd always heard the story that been revealed to him through one way or another that his son's spirit was a very, very, very valiant person in the war in heaven it was his privilege to escort Satan out of heaven.
Yes.
And this was somehow a blessing for his valiance.
Mm-hmm. That he received Down syndrome to protect him from temptation on earth.
Right. And I thought, wow, that's a fascinating story. Then I went on a mission to England, and I heard the same story about the other kid with Down syndrome in that state. And I heard about it somewhere else. And then there was the one in my very own mission. Everyone swears it happened. The guy, a soccer player, you're not supposed to be playing soccer on my mission, against the rules, who broke his leg. He didn't want to get in trouble, so he went to a spiritualist healer. mm-hmm. he healed his leg, and it freaked him out. Yes. This person can't hear my head. So he goes to his mission president.
And did he get a blessing?
No, he casted the devil out.
Yeah, okay.
And his leg broke again. And man, that's a good story. And then I got home, and my cousin who went to Brazil, he said, that happened in my mission too.
Yes.
So what I'm wondering is, what it brings me to is, there seems to be a real fascination with wanting, just a real desire, not just to share folklore, but a desire for the folklore to have happened now.
Yes.
And for it to have happened, not if not to you, close to you. Mm-hmm. You want to say it was in my mission, mm-hmm. it was this or that. And I was wondering why it seems that desire to have those stories almost trumps the desire to tell the truth.
This particularly happens on missions,
yes,
which are crazy, insane spiritual hothouses. And I think they generate this kind of energy.
Forms of entertainment.
Yes. And this sense of wanting immediate and present spiritual power in your life or on your mission. Because when you're on a mission, you know, if it happened to another elder, it might as well have happened to you, because you're all so tightly knit with each other. And, you know, I think to preserve the relevance of folklore, we want to give it the authority of this happened to my neighbor or to my brother-in-law. Or to whoever, that amps up the authoritative level and makes the story more powerful over us. And we want them to be powerful over us because they tell us lessons and things that we want to believe. So that is my opinion on that. But missions, there needs to be a book written about mission folklore. Because, I mean, they're all the same stories in every single different mission, but there's a lot of them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Matt. That was a great paper. I was curious if there's any Mormon folklore that attempts to explain the abominable snowman.
You know, there. I don't think so, because the abominable snowman is a different genus from Bigfoot.
But he's white.
Yes. And the abominable snowman's proper name is Yeti.
Right.
While, you know, the Bigfoot's proper name is Sasquatch. He is our Asian cousin. So we have not reached Tibet yet, but if we do, I think perhaps Yeti will become Cain as well. No.
Maybe that's happened. A friend of mine went to a meeting in, getting back to Weber County up in Huntsville, which is in eastern Weber County. The Ogden Standard Examiner had an article saying there'll be this meeting about Bigfoot. So my friend went to that. It's only been a week or two ago.
Oh, really?
And the guy got up and said that Bigfoot was Cain.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talked about a Bigfoot sighting, which is really Cain. And then different ones got up and talked about Bigfoot sightings. And I don't know whether they described it as Cain or not, but this went on for couple hours before my friend finally left.
It is alive and well.
Left, so
clearly,
it's still going on.
It is very much.
Jeffrey Meldrum.
Yes, Idaho State University.
ISU, mm-hmm. Member of the church, is a researcher of Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
He did a book signing. He wrote a book a number of years ago, and he did a book signing where I was at. He's also appeared on TV a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
I think considered some of the things. He's a
yeah.
serious investigator.
Yes.
He's investigated the Patterson film.
I actually footnote him in the paper. He is one of, I think, the school that I would call the hominologists. Those who believe that the Bigfoot should be studied scientifically as an animal among animals, rather than as a supernatural creature out to destroy us.
Does he disavow the Cain myth?
You know, I emailed him, and he would not comment on the Cain myth. So I think he is trying to distance himself as far as possible from the scientific aspect. Yes, sir.
This is probably a change, but you've talked about this change that we see in these ideas about Cain in Bigfoot.
Yes.
Have you noticed anything about changes in the stories about the three Nephites?
You know, I have not done much work on the three Nephites, but from what I have read from Bert Wilson and other folklorists who have done more work on them, is I mentioned them briefly early in the paper, and that seems to be what I described there, the arc of the three Nephite myths. They are the ones who are being increasingly assimilated into larger patterns of American folklore, but usually with a sort of apocalyptic Mormon twist towards the end. Yes, sir.
I have a theory about the three Nephites.
Sure.
It's been a long time since I've heard a recent story about the three Nephites. I think one of them wandered into Arizona and he got jailed and then deported. Every time I mention
no passport.
That's what happens.
I know with Bigfoot, a lot of the sightings tend, at least from what I've seen now, tend to be more about female Sasquatches.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if there's any kind of feminine Cain or female Cain version of these stories that are coming up?
Well, it's Cain's wife.
Does that actually come?
Yes, that has. In the 70s and 80s, that was kind of a bumpy spot in the road as hominologists begin to increasingly document multiple Bigfoots and adult Bigfoots with little baby Bigfoots and such like. This, of course, was a problem. If Bigfoot was Cain, how could there be lots of them? And so I did find a couple of stories which spoke of Cain's wife being cursed also. Or perhaps, as you said earlier, about the problem of Cain marrying outside the family. Cain had to go and marry a female Bigfoot because there weren't any other human beings. That was a single story. Any others?
Do you think that David Patton really saw something on his horse that day?
Thanks, Chris. Any others?
I have one kind of goes along with that.
Oh, go for it.
Okay. And that was, maybe you answered this and I didn't notice, but in the sightings by Woods Cross, did the woman who saw the guy on the hill and then went off to church, did she tell anybody? And so did that next story have something to be based on, or was that two independent sightings?
She did. Polly Markham, who saw Bigfoot in February 1980, she told her parents, and then eventually it leaked out. And the next morning, when the farmer, Ronald Smith, saw something, is when the reporter got involved and began interviewing people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got 10 minutes.
Okay, we got 10 minutes left. Anyone have stories of your own, or should we break early? We good? Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for coming, and